All right, so we're going to start today. There should be a text, or two texts, you know, one on each side that you got in the City of God. We're looking a little bit more closely at the City of God itself. And those texts are pretty long. So I'll give you a few minutes towards the later part of class to take a look at those. And we're going to discuss those. And we're really looking at, obviously, the doctrine of the two cities itself, how Augustine thinks about politics in a more general sense, and some specific questions related to it that we'll get into, including judgment, the necessity of judgment. One of my favorite passages that he's ever written is on there, and that's the dilemma of the judge, which is this famous passage of his, and I just really think it's kind of a, you know, very interesting reflection. I was going to say beautiful, but, and I think it is in a way, but it's beautiful in typically Augustinian sense. It's kind of dark. Darkness may be the theme of the day here today. So Augustine begins writing the City of God, as many of you will know, around 410, shortly after Rome is sacked, right? Rome is sacked by the Visigoths under King Alaric. Augustine starts writing the first few books of this text, which is, you know, 20 plus books long, so it's like Master and Commander in that sense. It's over 20 books long. The first few books appear just within the next 3 years, around 413. And as he tells us himself, both in the book, The City of God, and in his retractions, he writes this as a response to what he believes to be the untenable assaults of pagan writers against Christians, right? The pagan Romans, blame the Christians and the adoption of Christianity as the state religion for the demise of Rome, right? The betrayal of the Roman pantheon of gods has now paid off in Rome's inability to defend itself, right? And Augustine proceeds, especially in the first part of the book, right, the first half of The City of God, more or less, and especially even in those first few books, to just kind of shred through that pagan account, right? Shredding it by pointing to, in a sense, the absurdity of the Roman gods, the Roman system of gods. He does what you could argue, and some people have called, the first sociology of religion. He really sort of takes them at their words. These are your gods. He lines them up. He describes them, discusses them, and points to the incoherencies and the impotences that he finds in these gods. And again, some of you are, you know, quite familiar with this. He also then shows how the Visigoths seem to respect the god of Christianity in a way they don't the other gods. So, you know, this kind of, you know, backhanded way, you know, showing or revealing in another sense how the Christian God seems to be superior to these other gods. But that's not, generally speaking, why people turn to the text. They don't turn to it to read a nice, you know, interesting sociology of Roman religion. They turn to it for his reflections on our lives as Christians, the lives of Christians, the life of the church in society during the seculum, right? That's why most people look to this text. What are we to make of what we're supposed to be doing, how we're supposed to be living? What are we to make of the way the world changes, kingdoms rising and falling, so on, empires coming into being and then, you know, collapsing? What, if anything, is the meaning of all of this? And Augustine has the most dominant reflections on these problems in Western civilization. They influence everybody's reflections on history, the way we think about history unfolding, the notion of the secular, which we use all the time, right? Society is secularizing and so on. We use it right as though it's describing a cleansing process, right? This all traces back to Augustine, even though I would argue that conception of the secular that we use in the way, like, it's a cleansing process, right? Or it's a process of from our perspective, a toxification, perhaps, right, is not really his emphasis, right? His emphasis on the seculum is to describe a time, right? It would be opposed best to eternity. The seculum is now, right? It's what we all experience. It's the life before the end of times. The notion of the two cities, which again we go, you know, to his text for, that there's this earthly city and the city of God, is not actually original to him. Right? He's heavily influenced by Ambrose. We discussed that a little bit last time. But St. Ambrose has already used language quite similar to this, used language that Augustine adopts straight away. Ambrose speaks of the kingdoms of sin and the kingdom of sin and the kingdom of God. He equates the seculum, Ambrose does, the seculum, with the kingdom of sin. And he calls that also the temporal domain of the devil. Right? The kingdom of sin is the temporal domain of the devil. Ambrose himself, right, gets a lot of this from Origen. Okay, so they're not surprising, right? It's often the case that you think somebody invented something, right? Like with Bill Gates, right? We thought he invented, something. It's not really that person. What he's done and said is he's taken it, adopted it, popularized it, right? Maybe articulated it better than somebody previously. But these ideas are not novel to Augustine. They actually have deeper roots in the tradition. And of course, we would argue, right, they come out of Scripture itself, right? This is where Origen, Ambrose, Augustine finds them. You know, again, most of you, that for Augustine, what he's describing in these two cities is two communities formed around different loves, right? So Augustine's emphasis in this text is on love. And no surprising, it's on rightly ordered loving. The great separation in the secular is between those who love differently. That is the fundamental separation of our time, of time itself, is those who love God to the contempt of self, and those who love self to the contempt of God. That's it, right? I mean, this is the neatest sociological way of thinking about human beings, right? The cliche, there are two kinds of people, right? And we all sort of insert our two kinds, those who smoke and those who don't smoke. This is it. For Augustine, this is actually the fundamental division, right? Which would be those who sin and those who don't sin these days, right? It's whether or not you are ordered around the love of God or you're ordered around the love of self. These are, therefore, moral communities. I think it's important to understand these as moral communities. That is, they are founded by fundamental and imposed moral stances. Okay? Those moral stances create a division between them. And there's no middle ground. Right? There's no middle ground between them. We see moral stances like this all the time around us, and we see these kinds of divisions, right? So when I say there's no middle ground around it, sounds kind of harsh, right? It's kind of ancient. But, if you argue with anybody about politics today, right, it's pretty much, never Trumper versus, Trumper, or, whatever the issue is, right? We actually align ourselves in these ways, and Augustine, again, is not sort of overdrawing a contrast here. And while he does resist rather explicitly identifying these communities with visible historical communities, okay, he resists that, and we'll look at a text along those lines, I think it's also fair to say that their histories, right, the histories of these communities can actually be divided into the history of the earthly city and the history of the community of the faithful, in other words, the church, okay? So if you step back from it just a little bit, create some distance, you can speak more or less of the history of the church as that community that is trying to live ordered around God to the contempt of self. As you get closer, what you notice is, right, mess, complexity, people who go back and forth, and you'll see Augustine saying something along this line. So there is, as I keep saying, complexity in Augustine's account, a kind of messiness to all of this. I should have used that before. Do you know this phrase? This is a cliche that was bandied about at the time. Augustine refers to this in the City of God. If there's no rain, blame the Augustines, more or less. Blame the Christians, excuse me, is more or less what Augustine says. This is what's going around, right? The Christians are being blamed for everything. He defends them against that charge. This is the messiness quotation I wanted you to see. Book 18, chapter 49, right? Augustine quotes Matthew all the time to make this point. Right now in the world, during the seculum, this is how we live. This is our experience. There are many reprobate mingled with the good, and both are gathered together by the gospel as in a net. Right? Fish in a net, mingled together, not to be sorted until the boat comes in to shore, the net is open, right, and the fish are laid out on the beach. This is what we experience, a mingling of the good and the bad. You can't, in a sense, know until the end who's in, right? Who's in, right? The communities are not separated until then. They're mingled now, which is why it's primarily a moral community. I think there's a better way to think of it than identifying it visibly. Okay? It's a visible church. It's a visible state. Got it?
Roger?
Yes?
I guess I'm misunderstanding mingled. I thought that meant that within the church, there's a mingling of reprobate, and we can't even know within the church. Does he also mean a mingling within the human person that we can't know till the end?
At times, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, at times, yes.
But I guess in general, it's the moral communities you're talking about. That those two, City of God and City of Man, are mingled.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. But being a good Platonist, he's always going to be drawing a comparison between, right, the division that I think Father was talking about yesterday that's in the self, right, and the division that expresses itself in the social communities as well, right? They're always connecting to each other and in a sense informing each other. Yeah, he's humble about our capacity to know our own status, right? Yes, this is another great quotation on messiness. Anybody want to read this one for us out loud? Want an opportunity to speak up. Yeah, thank you very much.
Let these and similar answers, if any fuller and fitter answers can be found, be given to their enemies by the redeemed family of the Lord Christ and by the pilgrim city of King Christ. But let this city bear in mind that among her enemies lie hidden those who are destined to be fellow citizens, that she may not think it a fruitless labor to bear what they inflict as enemies until they become confessors of the faith. So too, as long as she is a stranger in the world, the City of God has in her communion and bounds to her by the sacraments some who shall not eternally dwell in the lot of the saints. Of these, some are not now recognized, others declared themselves, and do not hesitate to make common cause with our enemies in murmuring against God, whose sacramental badge they wear. These men you may today see thronging the churches with us, tomorrow crowding the theaters with the godless. But we have the less reason to despair of the reclamation even of such persons, if among our most declared enemies there are now some, unknown to themselves, who are destined to become our friends. In truth, these two cities are entangled together in this world and intermixed until the last judgment affects their separation.
Isn't this great stuff? Right? Isn't that just great? Right? So what is he saying here? What is he saying here? I mean, I love this stuff. This is great. It's what we experience, right? Yeah, what is he saying?
Well, it seems to me like he's, and comparing this with other passages, like he's using the two cities kind of on two different levels to describe both ideal types, the City of God and the City of Earth that have no communion with one another, that one is focused on God, the other is focused on human ends.
Right.
And then also at the lower type to describe the church and the seculum as intermingled, as you know, we have these ideal types and both internally and externally that's what we should be striving for, but in our daily lives, what we experience, we don't see that, we don't reach that because it's intermingled and it's Christ's job to untangle that.
Okay, good stuff. Anyone else? Right, I mean, you see, right, that there are, right, there are people in the earthly city who are destined to be with us. Right, and there are, of course, people thronging in the churches with us who are, right, who will be out there. And in both cases, it actually, right, it informs some hope that we continue to reach out, because who knows what's going to happen? Who knows whether the person outside the church won't eventually end up and actually be inflamed by passion for the love of God, right, and assist our own journey. Yeah.
It sounds explicit here, but you see also that there's predestinarian thought.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, those who are now in the earthly city, not united, or who seem to be members of the earthly city, in the end will have always been residents of the eternal city from in terms of their predestination for it.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. You can kind of see beneath right the text there, that in the background. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it brother?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Brother, you know, I think this quote of Augustine can even help on the issue of religious freedom we were talking about yesterday. Because it doesn't seem that being the church, that we are so clear boundaries, clear limits, visible limits. Because there are those who are in the church, who are throwing the church with us, but who are not really in it. And eventually those who are outside it, who are rather in it, because of their faith and their belief. So I think the...
Yeah, pocket that thought, right? And this keeps coming up, and we keep having to sort of set it aside. But pocket that thought. I'm pretty sure Friday was devoted some time to this, and, you know, and feel free to bring that back up in this context. Yeah, sure. I mean, right, you see a reading of this that would invite kind of capaciousness about people who hold other beliefs and our posture towards them. One second. Luke, and then brother. Yeah.
And certainly even more broadly, it implies that fight against the pagans is fought to redeem the foe, not to destroy him,
which is
going to inform his whole thinking on just war later on.
That's right, absolutely right. Great point. Yep, brother.
So yeah, I wanted to say, you know, from my understanding, Augustine saying that you can distinguish the two cities, each from the other, and then second, the city of God is still in the process, you know, it's not yet complete in terms of even say number, so it's still open to the scope of hope. So,
yeah. Right, no, it progresses in the world, right? It is, right, it is in movement in time itself, right? It is part of the seculum in that respect. You know, will it be there at the end of time? Will it be something, right, something different? It's sort of something invited for us to think about. Okay, so, all right, good. Going to Paul's question, right? We know ourselves, he's writing, of course, as a Christian, right? Or one who aspires to love God and love himself. And he knows as well his own difficulties in doing this, right? He aspires to this, and he knows nonetheless that he is sinful, right? And there's a kind of vacillation throughout the text which points to Paul's point about, okay, is this just about the communities, or is it also about us as individuals, right? Do we not experience, in a sense, this sort of backwards and forth motion? And there are times Augustine makes it pretty clear. He himself does, right? He himself does. So there's, as I said, a kind of constant connection between that kind of, Aristotle does the same thing, right? This notion that the individual as a divided being, right, also sort of that division is expressed socially. The social division is also rooted in internal divisions. The key then remains, right, love, right? That is the thing we can control, right, is the way we love something, right, and the effort to love things, right? So his emphasis is going to be not on, I think, what we would call social change or political change, right? Of course, that's a contemporary or relatively contemporary conception of things. His emphasis instead is going to be on love, right? Ordering loves, making sure loves are ordered internally, and making sure that their loves are ordered communally, and describing things in those terms, okay? Therefore, the best that we find during the Seculum in any city is a mixture of justice and injustice, right? Just as the best we find, arguably, in any person is some mixture of sinfulness and saintliness, or some, you know, or holiness, right? We can't expect, we don't anticipate in time perfect justice. And Augustine, part of what he's doing, of course, throughout this is desacralizing politics, right? He's evacuating politics of sacral importance. Okay, what happens now in the world, politically and otherwise, is of no consequence to salvation history. Right, we talked about this a little bit this morning over breakfast, right? From the perspective of salvation history, which has already been fulfilled in Christ, what happens politically does not matter. Okay? It does not matter, which leads, of course, some people to draw on Augustine for positions of complete detachment from political concerns, right? Lives of religious quietude, right? You can see why people might pull out of texts in Augustine's corpus that conclusion. I don't think, as I've said multiple times, that that's accurate. In what he argues is societies are mere collections of individuals, be they empires, kingdoms, provinces, cities. It does not matter. Okay? It does not matter. Empire is of no difference than is a province. Each man, he writes, is like a single letter in a sermon, equally prone to happiness or discontent as the other, regardless of the state of life. What is of consequence then is not the presence of justice or injustice, but their contentedness, right? So this eventually will lead to this famous passage, right, in Augustine about there being really no difference between a kingdom and a gang of robbers, right, or the mob, as I put it, right, justice being taken away. Once you recognize that matters of justice are of little salvific consequence, no salvific consequence, what are kingdoms but great robberies? For what are robberies themselves but little kingdoms? The band itself is made up of men. It is ruled by the authority of a prince. It is knit together by the pact of confederacy. The booty is divided upon by the law agreed on, right? Even robbers do this, right? Any good, right, Ocean's 11 type movie, right? They all agree how they're going to split up the stuff. There's a kind of law that regulates the community, right? It's fun to compare the mob or the mafia, right, to political society because they have rules. They have principles. There's codes of ethics, omerta, right? You don't betray each other. You don't kill. You don't target women and children, right? There are all kinds of, you know, rules of moral behavior associated with these things, and Augustine makes this point. It assumes the more plainly the name of a kingdom because the reality is now manifestly conferred on it, not by the removal of covetousness, but by the addition of impunity. Right? They're still greedy, right? They still want. They're still driven by love of self. Right, that's the covenant. It's just impunity now that confers on them legitimacy, the name of kingdom, the name of state, the name of empire. Indeed, right, the name refers to this great example. That was an apt and true reply which was given to Alexander the Great by a pirate who had been seized. For when that king had asked the man what he meant by keeping hostile possession of the sea, he answered with bold pride, "What do you mean by seizing the whole earth? But because I do it with a petty ship, I'm called a robber, while you who does it with a great fleet are styled emperor," right? If, right, you extract justice from these things, there's no difference between these communities. Let's see if this next slide works. We'll see if it works. This is this great scene in The Godfather, right, when, if you've not seen The Godfather, consider it part of your education, okay? I'm not requiring you to read the book, but if you want to be a good student, an elite student, I would read the book as well. There's even more on politics in The Godfather than there is in the movie, in the book, than in the movie. It's not going to work. Maybe it's not hooked up to the internet. Is that possible? Anyway, this is the great scene where Kate asks Michael Corleone, right, basically what, you know, what are your, what's the family business? And Michael says, you know, look, my father is no different from, you know, politicians. And she said, you know, Michael, what are you, crazy, right? Like, of course, you know, you're politicians don't, don't have men killed, right? Don't have men killed. Politicians, like presidents and senators, don't have men killed. And Michael turns to her and says, who's being naive, right? Like, who's the naive one here, right? There's no difference between what we do except the mark of impunity, right, is Michael's great claim in this point. So Mario Puzo, the author, was clearly Augustinian, and that's to his credit. Okay, yeah. There's another slide here. Hold on. Pardon for the order here. What happens for Christians, right, is that some of what Augustine says fuels a sense of superiority among them. But Augustine says, look, we're not really superior to anybody else. We are captured by this same itch of lust, this itch of lust, which, of course, suggests, right, his sexual, right, analysis, his own autobiography. But it's not just that. It's also the libido dominandi, which he writes about, this lust for power that we have, which expresses itself not simply in the political realm, it expresses itself in the relationships we have between each other as human beings, even, of course, in the family. And it's only, right, by being free from this that we actually become fully free ourselves. We, as Christians, don't have any means to boast. We're as captive to these things as anybody else is. So let's turn to the judge, right, real quick. This is the thing. Our first responsibility as Christians, right, is to sort of remain in the game loving other human beings. Okay? He does not countenance detachment or quietude. Okay? We've seen that over and over. Augustine is constantly writing to people in authority. He's inserting himself into political questions all the time, or they are coming to him and asking him to weigh in on certain questions, and he does over and over again. Here is a description in the City of God. This is book 19, chapter 6, so it's towards the end. This is a description of the brokenness of the world we inhabit, the difficulty of pursuing justice in a world such as this, for reasons that he'll suggest in the text, right? And nonetheless, the necessity of our staying in the game. Okay? All right, take a look at it, and then we'll discuss it. Let's just start. What's interesting? What do you find interesting about the passage before we try to analyze it?
Anything of interest?
Yeah.
I was like, the psychological experience as I was reading this, like the job of the judge is so awful, and there's even this one sentence, because Latin is terribly translated in English, there, you know, things that the judge is doing are just worse and worse and worse.
Right.
And you get to the end, and it's kind of okay.
Oh, you mean it's kind of okay, and it's a permissible okay? Or it'll all be well.
Like, my expectation was that Augustine's going to say, no one should ever be a judge.
Right. Yeah, so permissible. Anybody else? Anything else of interest to anybody? Yeah.
Maybe the person who's converted doesn't necessarily change their job, but they see the misery involved in their job, rather than sort of feeling exalted by doing it.
You mean the Christian, in other words, sees the job as for what it is.
It's an inward change about you.
Good stuff. Anybody else? Yeah, Luke.
It's interesting how much the emphasis is actually on ignorance.
Yes, right.
The impossibility of certain knowledge.
Right.
Even more than it is on moral corruption or
that's
ambiguity.
Right. I agree with that. I think that's right, a great point. And I mean, there's stuff to say about this, right? I saw a couple more hands today.
I was just going to comment on how it recognizes the complexity that the fall created in that, you know, this is a job that has to be done, but look at how horribly it can go just because, you know, the miserable state of the world. He's kind of reminding us that, you know, even this very noble job of the judge is, you know, completely imbued with kind of an unavoidable kind of evil that will occur.
Right, and related to Luke's point, it's not even an issue of it can go, right? This is the way it is, right? Ignorance is shot through processes of judgment, according to him, he's claiming, right? There are always going to be aspects or elements of ignorance in them.
So I think the category of lamentation is key for this, right? So the Lord delivered me from my necessities. What he's not saying is that, and this is to your point, that in the fallen human condition, there is in fact not an escape from this, right? The prayer is to be delivered,
right?
But it's not going to happen now.
That's right. That's a great point. Well done. Paul, I know you just want to make sure I'm not getting anybody else.
And other people who don't typically raise a hand, they're encouraged to raise a hand.
Yes,
Paul.
Just a question, is it an assumption then that Augustine is saying, although this is horrible, it beats the alternative of not even trying to have human justice?
This goes to Philip's point. Do you want to respond? I mean, doesn't it write about the necessity, this is
necessary. Yeah, it's not right. I mean, I think the case
is unavoidable.
Thinking of it in terms of necessity, right? So there are, again, there's no unmixed goods, right? You have a good of justice, but that's going to implicate you in wickedness. To have that good, it's going to be shot through with darkness in this world.
And we have to be careful about the term wickedness, right? Because what does he say? Right, now it's miserable. Right, it's miserable and it's unfortunate. Right, but are we going to accuse the judge, who's ignorant, right, of evil?
He says twice, and he considers it. He thinks it no wickedness that innocent witnesses are tortured regarding the crimes. These numerous and important evils, he does not consider sins. And so I think there's an element where in Augustine where it seems like. Within the context of the fallen world of necessity, you know, to some degree, excuses or at least reduces the problematic behavior, nature of the behavior.
Necessity plus ignorance.
Yeah.
Right? Right. The necessity right, involves us in it. The ignorance, such as there is in a practice like this, excuses. But it's of course, complex. These are mixed goods, as you said. Paul, okay. And there's torture, right? There's torture in here, right? That's kind of interesting, isn't it? Right? Seems relatively unproblematic, except, of course, it's part of the misery of the world, right? This is how we learn. This is how we find out stuff. This is how investigations and interrogations go. You coerce people into giving information, and sometimes you know this. Like, you know, sometimes when we coerce people into providing information, eventually they're going to say they did something they didn't do. Right? And that's the consequence of the brokenness of this world. We live with that brokenness. He would, I think, reject any idea that we can escape that brokenness. Right? That we could create, for instance, a process of law and punishment that provided complete knowledge, complete certitude, right? We're broken. We can't have that. Yeah.
And in that sense, Augustine departs from Plato here, right? Because Plato also talks about ignorance and virtue of the care of the self. You know, that we should, to govern well, or maybe also to judge well, overcome our ignorance towards the truth. You know, and in Plato, I think there is a possibility to overcome this by having access to truth, by virtue of careful to self. Whereas here, ignorance is not able, cannot be overcome, right?
Not always, no. Yeah.
But I don't know how much he departs from Plato about politics. Right? It might be possible even for Augustine level the individual soul to some extent.
Right.
In anything but the best city, this is going to happen.
Right, in anything but the final city, right?
Right. Then that's the difference, right? The best city becomes the final city. It's a temple. It's a historical move.
That's right. Exactly. This is going to happen. I wouldn't argue with your play that he departs from Plato, but I think you might be able to find texts in Plato that support that. Once you're talking about the political realm, right, you're going to get a different set of possibilities with regard to truth. But I'll defer to the Plato scholars in the room. That's not my thing. Yes, brother.
Yeah. So it's not the kind of pessimistic. I don't know. Augustine seems to be a bit pessimistic about human condition in general or in the human society. I'm not trying to compare him with Thomas, my great master. Thomas, the way he speaks of justice, we still have some great trust or hope in what can come out from even human judgment. So it's just my question to you, who knows Augustine more than I do? So I don't know. It seems to have this pessimistic view of human society. You see that, okay, for him, the only solution is just to get out and then reach the city of God. I don't know.
No, it's clearly not, right? The man will take a seat as the judge, he'll take a seat at the bar, right? Christian will do this, yeah.
So I think this is also an interesting passage in terms of thinking about the epistemic uncertainty, right? So I got the issue of torture is particularly interesting in that now we would say torture is in fact an intrinsically evil act, right? So the question of wickedness that I broached earlier, right? Augustine doesn't think it's problematic, but he's wrong on this, right? Like that torture would be permissible in order to elicit confession. This is in fact wrong, even though he doesn't know it, right? And so I think just the question of epistemic uncertainty is interesting, because Augustine does, he addresses that, so you have levels of ignorance here as well.
Right. I think so, but I took Luke's point, tell me if I'm overreading your point, in part to be something along the lines of, look, don't focus on the particulars here, like of the torture, right? Because obviously we would say, different things about torture, and we might even want to sort of explore, when he's using the word for torture here, does he mean quite the same thing as we might mean, or does he mean, enhanced interrogation techniques, or does he mean, we're back to coercion again, like what are we talking about, right? But I think the point is there's an inescapable ignorance associated with judging.
That's what I was trying to get to broaden the question here, in that, like, I think Augustine is less confident in the powers of the human intellect and judgment than Thomas is. But he's less confident. I think that's, in fact...
Look, he may be, I'm gonna step out and say something I shouldn't in a second. I'll direct it to the Dominicans in the room. It's been a long time since I've read Thomas on capital punishment. He may be, but look, he's not saying that there's not capacity to judge correctly, right? He's not saying we can't make correct judgments in law, for instance, right? You can. However, there's always uncertainty, even the uncertainty of the judge who's made a correct judgment but doesn't know it. Right? I don't know that when I interrogated this person, I didn't pull from him something that he didn't really mean to say. Right? So by virtue of this position, which he says we should, right, the man should take, you are involving yourself in a process that is necessary for social order, that is necessary for the right good of your neighbor, but it's going to involve you in, geez, I wonder about that case that I decided 36 years ago, right? It still wakes me up at night because I just wasn't sure. And you're right, and the guy can go ask the prisoner, the guy in the cell, and say, and the guy might say, yeah, I didn't. He still might go home and say, I'm not sure, he's got he doesn't have false conscience here or something, right? Right, this is a feature of the world. Ignorance is a feature. So, these are great, conversation points. The torture, of course, has to be dealt with on its own, but that's not the point, right? The point, I think, instead is, to go to Father's point, it's a miserable existence to some extent, right? So Augustine begins the City of God with a reference to Habakkuk. Right, and in Book 19, he makes another reference to the prophet, the minor prophet Habakkuk. The just man will live by faith, or lives by faith. We live by faith, despite of the miseries around us. And the City of God, he's constantly pointing out the miseries associated with living. I'm sorry. I wish it was happier, right? But even his account of war, right? Famous, you know, you want to begin talking about just war theory, you start from St. Augustine, and what does Augustine say? War is awful, right? War is terrible. And it's terrible in manifold ways, and he provides, you know, this, you know, a kind of colorful and wonderful description of how awful war is. And then nonetheless, more or less, says Christians can do this, right? Should do this. If, right, all, you know, certain kinds of conditions are in place. So, good, really good stuff. Kyle, sorry, I had you wait.
Yeah. On Philip's point, I think on the torture issue specifically, there's also an issue of contextual difference being considered here, because a big part of the reason that we consider torture as intrinsically wrong is that we can now see the other options. We have evidential sciences, we have psychological studies telling us about the effects of torture, we have psychological studies into the nature of deceit and identifying deceit that Augustine doesn't have access to, and the judges in his day don't have access to. And so, you know, and I'm not denying that there were other options then, but I think we get back to the necessity of ignorance issue where maybe they can't see the other options. Maybe those other options aren't epistemically available to them.
Sure, I mean, he doesn't know that it's wrong, but it was still wrong when he did it, right? I mean, this is the important point, I think, about intrinsically evil actions, right? There isn't a circumstance in which it could be justified.
Well, and I think that this gets to...
Listen, I mean, that's right. Look, again, we can talk about that on Friday. Okay, I'm going to punt that one to Friday as well, if you guys want to. There's good stuff there. But the thing I was going to mention to the Dominicans is, doesn't Thomas, in talking about capital punishment, also acknowledge that there will be people who are improperly sentenced? Do you know this or not, or am I wrong in remembering that? Am I misremembering his
Like, I mean, he certainly does occasionally talk about the possibility that there's an error. We talked about this yesterday.
Okay. Then what?
There could be an error in the judicial process, and the judge should still follow the process.
I think he even talks about it in the context of capital punishment that there could be error. But anyway, so I how far apart they are, I think, would be really kind of interesting to see. Obviously, again, these are different types of texts, right? And Augustine is really sort of emphasizing, you know, I guess it's not surprising, but I think, you have to go to how realistic is this? How apt a description of the things, you know, that we experience and the world we experience? He's emphasizing what it's like to live in the secular, right? And he says at one point, I think it's even again in Book 19, he says something along the lines of the virtues, which are our best, right, and truest possessions. We've been talking about virtue a lot, right? He acknowledges these are wonderful things, right? This is good Platonist again, right? These are the things that we can claim in a sense, right? But for him, they are only reminders of the miseries of this life, right? They really ultimately are reminders of the miseries of this life, because you construct a life, right, built around being good and so on, and then stuff happens, right? Things collapse, you get sick, and you know, you can't control yourself the way you thought you could control yourself. Other things intervene, right, and obstruct your capacity to do what you thought you could do. People are taken from you, you know, and so on, right? So, even right, he's full dark, right? Hard fall in this stuff at this point, okay? But I think the point, I think we've made the point with this passage. There's no detachment here from this, and from the miseries of our neighbors, right? We, those who occupy the city of God, know that these miseries are just trials, right? Our neighbors, however, don't, right? The citizens of the earthly city don't know that these are mere trials. They think this is it, right? And this can lead them to despair. It can lead them to cruelty. It could lead them to detachment from things. And he argues against all of those. Again, the just man lives by faith. Okay? The Christian lives by faith. In other words, despite what he sees around him of misery, he lives in faith. He lives in hope. Yeah.
I think what's fascinating is that the compulsion comes from both sides, right? And two-thirds of the way down there.
Yeah.
It's both that he thinks it a wickedness to abandon the society, and the society constrains him and compels him to his duty. and there's this reciprocal sense of
it's great
must
point.
Be done.
Yeah, what do you take away from that? Like, what, like?
Well, it's interesting that he acknowledges that society does have a legitimate authority, right? There's a real compulsion from its side, as well as the Christian's own judgment that out of charity, I can't abandon these people. And the language of abandonment is interesting too, right?
Yeah, yeah. What else might we take from that? Like the sense that society compels you to do this, to be part of this, even as somebody regards him or herself as a member of the city of God. What else might we draw from that? I guess what I'm thinking of in part is often another sort of division between Thomas and Augustine, or a purported division between them, is on the social nature of the human being, right? That Thomas thinks of the human being as much, you know, as inherently social, naturally political, in a way that some people argue Augustine does not. Augustine can be the kind of father of a certain kind of individualism that develops over time in the West, right? You know, I don't think that, again, I don't think that that's accurate to Augustine. I think it's, you know, it drives a wedge too deeply between the two of them. And maybe here we're seeing something of that sense of there is a kind of inherent connectedness of us as letters, right? Letters in a sermon. We are letters. We're discrete. But we're part of something. Right? It seems to me. I don't know if that's part of what you were getting at there, Luke, or not. Okay, good. All right, so let's look at number one. This is, again, one of his fears, as you know, right, throughout Augustine's writing is the sin of pride, right? He's obsessive about how pride corrupts us. And he spends a lot of his time in the text defending Christians against attacks, right? And defending them against the attacks of pagan authorities. And he does so by exalting Christianity over Christian God, over the pagan gods, exalting the city of God over the earthly city. But he always is warning Christians against feeling superior. And in addition, even while he's diminishing Rome, because Rome is just a part of the secular, right? Rome is an empire that, you know, rises and falls as empires will. So he compares it to Babylon and so on, right? They come and they go. He also does recognize the greatness of Rome. Rome was great. Rome achieved things similar empires did not achieve. He's a Roman citizen, and you can see a sense of pride about being a Roman citizen, even to the point that, again, it reminds him not to take pride in being a Christian. So read this passage, take just a couple of minutes reading this passage, and then we'll discuss it. It's another passage I love. Easy to pass over when you're reading
it. Yeah. It's incredible, but it's very striking the, you know, the implicit contrast between Brutus and Torquatus and Abraham and Isaac.
Yeah.
Right? That Christ does not even require such sacrifices.
Right.
As even the city may. So there's this sense of how sort of radically it goes one better. That even as a much greater good, it actually requires less of us in a strange way.
It's interesting, right? If he's saying that, that it might actually require less of us than Rome itself required of its citizens. What is the point? What is the point he's making? Or what are some of the points he's making here? You see multiple points. Yeah, Paul.
Is it a fortiori argument that these Romans, for the sake of earthly glory, were willing to sacrifice their own children, and we are called not even to that great of a sacrifice, so a fortiori, it should be easier for us to sacrifice for the sake of the kingdom? But to your point about pride, it seems like he's saying, look, if you've given up everything for the sake of the kingdom, you shouldn't be proud that you've done it, because you haven't even done as much as these Romans have done for the sake of earthly glory.
Right, right. That's pretty cool. There's no special merit, right, in doing these things. Romans were prepared to and did do things that none of you's ever been asked to do. None of you has been asked to sacrifice your children. And these great Romans, these heroic Romans did. What else do we see in there, in this passage? I mean, there's stuff to think about, right, with this account. There's stuff to question. Is our sacrifice not as great as theirs? Is the sacrifice less than theirs? Now, in some ways, right, obviously, right, like having to give up a child seems like the greatest sacrifice of all. Yeah.
It's also interesting just how generous he is to Roman self-apologizing, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
this is living that he's just sort of lifting whole cloth and he
right.
accepts it.
Yes.
Which elsewhere he's not necessarily willing to do, but...
No, but he does. And there are times he'll do it explicitly, more or less saying, look, take it on its face value, right? I'm not going to even ask questions about how close the truth this is. Let's just look at it in their own words. And even if you look at it in their own words, right, these things seem to follow. Yeah, Amy?
So it seems like in the second paragraph it's also not only being generous, but it's also saying this to be an example for Christians and where it's parallel between the trust rooms and what they're really for in Romanism.
Right.
And so the idea of directing the temporal order towards heavenly virtue and using them as a model for how we should feel towards the heavenly home.
Mm-hmm. Right, so it becomes exemplary, right? Other questions? I mean, there's good stuff in there about virtue, even, right? There's a line that sort of suggests something about the relationship of the virtues that the Romans themselves had, right? And he uses kind of weaselly words at that point, but, right, we know the difficulties he's having in trying to sort of account for Roman virtue throughout the text, throughout the whole text, not just this passage here, right? What do you think? What do you think about the nature of the sacrifice? Is he right that Christians are not called to make the kinds of sacrifices these Romans made? Or is he again just taking things at face value, sort of lining them up, temporal versus temporal? Yeah.
In some sense, it seems that the sacrifice that he and his fellow Christians are making is more difficult because with Rome, you can see the tangible, there's a public event, I'm sacrificing my son, the crowd maybe cheers, or they see this person admires Rome more than his own flesh. And so there's a tangible, real, proximate result. Whereas the sacrifice that people make for the sake of the kingdom, we have glimpses of the reward, but it's taken on faith in a way that I guess the Roman reward wasn't necessarily.
Good stuff. Anybody else? Yeah.
To add to that, this sentence where he says that it's not for desire or human praise, as the Romans had, but reckon among our sons Christ's poor ones, so that kind of, it doesn't look very praiseworthy from an earthly vantage point.
It doesn't. But what does he think of earthly praise? Do you know? He's got some great lines on this. One of them, one of my favorites, is where he talks about how Romans were, you know, concerned themselves with, you know, remaining on the lips of dying men, right? Right, and it's beautiful, right? Because on the one hand, we get it. On the other hand, he's completely demolished, right? The notion of glory, right? Or he's really sort of subverted the notion of glory. This is just stuff that mortals do, right? And, you know, mortals, you know, they exchange their names and they come and go, right? Empires, again, collapse. And whether you're going to be remembered beyond the collapse of an empire is unclear, right? And right, there are names that people once remembered and nobody remembers any longer because it's all in the seculum. It doesn't really matter. That goes to, I think, Luke's point about the separation between the ends that are involved here, right? One is one end, one good, one reward is infinite. The other one is the lips of dying men, right? A murmur on the lips of dying men. Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's a strike. I thought the last line was one of the most striking, where he says, terrestrial and temporal benefits, that divine providence and grand and permissiveness is both good and evil.
Right.
And so he sounds almost suspicious of it.
Yeah, right. And that, yeah, sorry, yeah.
Well, what he sounds like is Christ. He makes the rain to fall upon both the just and the unjust. It's this idea that within the created order, evil's not punished right away. In fact, often the unjust have good things.
Right. Why do bad things happen to good people, right? After there's a book or something like that, right? Or, you know,
why do good things happen to bad people?
And why do good things happen to bad people? Well, because that's God's providence, right? And good people, again, the righteous man. And if you read, if you go back and look at Habakkuk now, after, you know, knowing this, read it. It's a story of a guy living in the midst of misery, right? Who nonetheless persists in faith and wonders, God, why? Right? Why am I surrounded by misery? And Augustine's answer is, of course, look, that's God's providence. And the righteous man lives by faith nonetheless. He knows the miseries are a test. He knows the miseries are just punishments for our sinfulness. Right? We merit no better than that misery. But we know how to make use of it if we are faithful. And those who are not faithful are trapped. They can't see the misery for what it is. Right? They might even see it as not miserable. Right? They might actually think they're thriving and not recognize, right, what is real. That their lives here and now, right, are only going to be saved by Christ, if saved at all. And Augustine, you know, his hard predestination doctrine, arguably, sort of coursing throughout the text as well. Yeah, how about it is?
It says about, you know, happiness, that, you know, pursuing earthly goods and trying to be happy in this world won't work, because you can only be happy that only God can make us happy.
Right, right. It's a famous text, this, right, on that same kind of point. Yes.
You also get the intimations again of the two loves, right? Because and this is the question for, I mean, the perennial question of whether pagans have virtue at all, right? Because all of their efforts and striving are oriented toward the being on the lips of dying men,
right?
Does that count as a virtue? It's an interesting question. It certainly merits something in Augustine's eyes, but it merits exactly something passing. So, I mean, it's interesting that Christians can learn from what may not be virtue,
right?
But can learn a path to true virtue,
right? Which are in whatever way resembled by, right? Which are in whatever way.
I was just going to say that off of that, it's kind of like I think of this question in the same way Aquinas is talking about how we learn how to love God analogously to love a neighbor, and how like even regardless of whether or not that's out of charity, it's the love that like. I mean, here it was emphasized as the nobility of the love rather than the love itself, it seems, mm-hmm. and kind of the strength with which
they
love, and it's, Christ's poor ones, almost, that brings up the point of, like, all you need is your love of God, and that's what you're saved by. You're not saved by your strength or your, and that's not really the point I was trying to try and kind of lost my train of thought, but it was,
try to get it back. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, maybe this one. Resembled by those virtues which they held fast to for the sake of whatever terrestrial city. Mm-hmm. I mean, the value is limited to that for the sake of the terrestrial city, ultimately, unfortunately. But that's.
It is. And as I said, I think it was yesterday, right? He acknowledges in the City of God earlier that. Those virtues that the Romans cultivate for the sake of glory of the city are superior to the virtues of other poli, right, that have cultivated virtue for the sake of accumulation, for the sake of wealth, for the sake of other goods. So there is a recognized like hierarchy of goods, and then of course virtues that, you know, more or less approximate in whatever way, I think, right, his language, real virtue. And the end of glory, he wants to say, right, that's better than the end of money, for instance, or wealth, which animated, and you can see courage, and you can see, you know, or apparent courage, right, some kind of courage. You can see some kind of justice. Monsters will divide their goods equally, right? Or, you know, in ways that they've already laid out beforehand, right? There appear to be these kinds of things. The Romans were better than their peers or their predecessor empires, their predecessor kingdoms. And look, he's a Roman, right? Not a shock that he might argue something along those lines. But even better washes out, ultimately, right? From the perspective of salvation history, from the perspective of real virtue, it washes out. It could serve as an exemplar for us now, but from stepping back on it, you recognize, look, it's all kind of based by comparison to ordering your life around love of God. Now, just I'll finish here with this quotation, right? And you probably all have read it by this point, right? Making the point for the 15th time before we get into sort of more contemporary reappropriations of Augustinian thought. If Christianity were the religion of the community, you'd see good citizens. Christianity is not opposed to being a good citizen. We were making this point, you know, in conversation yesterday about, you know, how so many Catholics, you find them in the military. Right? And either they're wrongly formed, right, and shouldn't be there, or it might actually relate itself to the way Catholics understand their responsibilities, their duties to the communities they inhabit, or some combination of the two. Right? Yet were our religion listened to as it deserves. He's writing to Marcellinus, right? Roman, I think, Secretary of State. Were it listened to as it deserves, it would establish, consecrate, strengthen, and enlarge the commonwealth in a way beyond all that Romulus, Numa, Brutus, and all the other men of renown in Roman history achieved. Wherefore, let those who say the doctrine of Christ is incompatible with the state's will of being give us an army composed of soldiers such as the doctrine of Christ requires them to be. Let them give us such subjects, such husbands and wives, such parents and children, such masters and servants, such kings, such judges and fine, even such taxpayers and tax gatherers, as the Christian religion has taught that men should be, and then let them dare to say that it is adverse to the state's civitas, right, just look at the word there, the state's well-being. Yea, rather let them no longer hesitate to confess that this doctrine, if it were obeyed, would be the salvation of the commonwealth. Okay? All right? Yes?
Is that final phrase, salus abras publicae? Because that's a super resonant Roman political phrase.
Probably is, yeah. Surprised to see it.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, Paul.
This sounds beautiful, a beautiful right. Vision. Can we contrast it a bit with what we spoke about earlier, the passage about the kingdom of law? And
yeah.
When you shared that with us, I was almost despairing that Augustine would not even allow for striving for a political common good, in the sense that from that I got the impression of the mob that
right.
You kept talking about rescinding from justice or taking justice right. out of it, and it's all the same. That's a very dark. It seems like a very dark view of the possibilities of human
right.
of human community. Whereas this last one. It's almost like he says, well, if everybody were baptized, well, sure, there'd be Christendom, and sure, we... My question is, in between, what do we do in the meantime, where the post facto... Would he say that in a pluralistic culture, there can be a political common good, that a good Christian should strive for a political common good?
Would he say that in a pluralistic society, what
would
the
other qualifications? That a faithful Catholic Christian.
What I'm emphasizing, what I think he's emphasizing, is what a faithful Christian will do is love his and love his enemy, right? He will love in community, and that's the point of emphasis, not the attainment of justice, right? Because It's not to say that, in a sense, different sociological possibilities wouldn't present, you know, different strategic choices, right? very, 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 you know, inadequate and shorthand history, right? I think he even says here, in the other quotation where he talks about the great masters and slaves, right? This is not an age when these people think in terms of social justice, right? Pushing for societal change with regard to the ordering of classes, relationships between kinds of occupations and so on, right? His emphasis is, I think, throughout on what individuals can do as individuals, but also members of the corpus, right? So you're all working towards the common good, in essence, by loving properly, right? Loving in a way that's ordered towards the love of God. When you are ordered that way, right, you are forming that polis, that city of God. And that city of God will be a better, right, it will create better citizens of the earthly city than the earthly city itself can have, because it's pursuing some conception of justice, right, the very pursuit of which, Augustine might argue, is a specter, right? It's a mirage about what justice actually entails. It's not genuine in the way that those who order their lives around God will know what is genuine and what is achievable. So, I mean, one way to look at it, right, 2,000 years of history is to say, geez, if we're measuring in terms of social justice, it's been an abject failure, right? Slavery is replaced by racial injustice, or, you know, whatever, right? Systems of slavery are replaced by systems of fascism and, you know, authoritarianism, justified by good people, apparently good people, on the basis of, you know, good intentions and so on, right? This is that really dour Augustine about the possibility of social attainment of these things, right? It doesn't mean you're not enlisted always to be beside your neighbor, right? And assisting your neighbor, even as a judge, right? Even in these other roles, even as a soldier, right? He said, we'll be the best soldiers, right? And again, you go to the Naval Academy and it's 50% Catholic, right? Why is that? Maybe they're all screwed up, right? Sometimes you read some Catholic theologian, you see, like, right, we're pulling out of the military thing. We're pulling out of use of force. What I write on. And I think that that's, you know, a failure to see his point, that actually love is what draws us into those things. Not that we're going to attain greater justice in some, you know, deep sense, but instead that we're going to defend those of our neighbors who need defending, the poor ones who are currently being threatened by something that we are capable of judging as evil. Yeah.
Just on this point, I think
it's a great point, Paul.
Yeah, it really is. I think reflecting on these passages about, you know, helping out your neighbor and being the best citizen that one can be. I think Augustine, in a way, is sort of pushing forward political pragmatism or prudence, as opposed to, you know, a sort of political utopianism, right? That is also criticized throughout Catholic social and political thought. We get that Thomas More later on, and then much later, 19th century. But you also sort of, I mean, on the other hand, you know, the critique of political utopianism doesn't mean that you should strive towards a better society, right? And you do that by doing that in the sort of local, in your local community, by loving your neighbor and
sure. I think you could still ask whether he's saying strive towards a better society. But I get it. Like, I think we live in a different age, right? Where social possibilities are sociologically different than they were then, right? Just a really quick anecdote. One of my favorite ones, I studied the development of doctrine around slavery for my dissertation, and there's this great moment in the 1860s when the American bishops get together, right, and the country is beginning to tear itself apart, right, over the issue of slavery, there were a couple of newspapers who write this, you know, the nation awaits the bishops, you know, the Catholic bishops. Of course, the nation's not Catholic, but they want to see what this church that's not tearing itself into pieces, because Protestant ones are, right, is going to say about the issue of slavery. And the bishops come out of a plenary council they have in Baltimore, and they say, it's a political issue, it's not a social issue. In other words, this is not for us to weigh in on, right? We are bishops. We deal with very, sort of discrete moral questions. We don't deal with political issues. That's something that, people vote on. They, at that point, at the minimum, have that kind of antique conception of possibilities, right? They're operating out of this mode that there's a very sharp division between social justice, right, or social change, bringing about into being certain kinds of societies, as opposed to simply saying, love your neighbor, right? So you get, at the same time, moral Catholic manuals written by American bishops and American moral theologians that say things like, masters, treat your slaves well, and slaves, do your duties towards your masters. And if masters will allow their slaves to marry, receive the sacraments, and so on, and of course not beat them and things like that, then slavery is not necessarily sinful, right? There's no, and project backwards to Augustine, there's no conception, let's go out and protest against slavery, right? Let's bring into being a better society. It's instead, love your neighbor. Order your life around love. And by doing that, right, you are doing what a Christian is called to do. Okay? I'll stop there.